So I grew up on a steady rotation of reading Brown Bear, Brown Bear, Chicka Chicka Boom Boom, and stories from my Kid First Bible. You know the kind I'm talking about? It takes a couple of headline stories from the Bible, although I do wonder how a few of them made it in. It adds some illustrations, we take out the extreme violence and other PG-13 scenes, and voila, you have a kid's bedtime story. Well, mine was from the late 90s, when it was really cool to have a buckle or like a locket on the outside of your book. I don't know if that's still a trend with your kids. But mine had a bright green buckle on the outside, and I thought it was really cool. But as much as I could tell you about the outside of this book, I really only remember one story from inside of it. And it was my favorite, and it was The Good Samaritan. But in full confession, I don't remember the exact story that was just read aloud for us this morning. But nevertheless, I would say that this story was my first memory of being captivated and compelled by the gospel Jesus came proclaiming. This story was full of compassion, and I remember there being a man beaten dead on the side of the road, and maybe there were two other people that didn't stop. I don't really remember that part. But then there was this other man, the Samaritan, who owed this beaten man nothing and simply out of compassion was moved to right the wrong. Oh, I loved this story, and just my heart swelled at this story of love. And then I remember this story coming around in children's church, and our big takeaway is everybody is my neighbor. And if all you took away from this story is a story of compassion and the universalizing of your neighbor beyond geographical location or beyond common interests or family bloodlines, that's certainly a good place to start. There is much more happening in this story. See, now, the thing is that this story was told to critics and cynics who had arrogant egos. And I have a theory that you have to have some criticism and cynicism and maybe some arrogance, and you too, to really hear how this story would have fallen on the audience that day. And luckily, I'm not four anymore. I have all of those things in plenty. So now, whenever I hear this story, I feel a little bit more of a sting compared to the symphony of warm fuzzies that used to swell in me. Let's turn to our story. So our person asking the questions is not an innocent child with a genuine spirit of curiosity. We have a lawyer, an expert in religious law, putting Jesus to the test. He uses his questions like a surgical knife to the commands. We have the ultimate command come out in our story, to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. But then, who is my neighbor? Comes out of this spirit of wanting to be justified. But I have to admit, I don't mind the question. I really love clearly defined terms and boundaries, and I enjoy a really good debate where we set out defining all of our terms at the beginning. Sure, I might not endorse the spirit that he asked it in, but maybe I was asking that too. Who is my neighbor? Now, before we jump to everybody is my neighbor, let's listen to the story carefully. All right, so a man got beaten and robbed, left half dead on his journey. So first, our priest walks by and moves to the other side. Okay, so our top-ranking defensive hitter of religious professionals just struck out. That's okay. We have our second-string Levite coming up to bat, and he strikes out looking. He moves to the other side. Okay, Jesus, I see what you're doing. Our third-string bench warmer is going to come in, and he's going to win the game. It's our Jewish layperson. We'll get a story about leadership and integrity and status. I'm good with that. But no, Our third person is not a Jewish layperson. Our third person is a Samaritan. This is the third string bench warmer from your rival hometown's team, basketball team, coming into your baseball lineup, who steps up to the plate and hits a walk-off home run. You might be very familiar with the feud between the Jews and the Samaritans. The Samaritans come from the northern tribes of Israel, and when they were taken into exile, they intermarried. The Jews did not. The Jews have Jerusalem, and the Samaritans have their temple. The Jews have had wars with the Samaritans for centuries. The list could go on and on of all the reasons why the Jew would be so offended to hear that the Samaritan is offering love. To the Jew, the Samaritan is blasphemous, weak, morally corrupt. They've turned their back to the God that the Jews remain faithful to. By using a Samaritan in this story, Jesus is subverting the identity that the Jews have assigned to the Samaritans. I would imagine that not only did the Jews not want the Samaritans' love, their cheap, compromised love, but the Jews probably don't even believe that the Samaritans have the capability to love. And Jesus lays it on thick about how well this Samaritan can love. He bandages this man himself. He pours out his own oil and wine. He puts him on his own animal. He takes him to an inn, gives him 2 days' worth of wages, and offers to follow up with his actual presence and more money if needed. And nowhere does the Samaritan ask, did this man do something to get beaten up? Did he fall in with the wrong crowd? Does he owe somebody money? No. The Samaritan just offers mercy. He just meets the need right in front of him, no questions asked. It seems as though there's a question here in the subtext. Who do you think can be a neighbor? Not just who is your neighbor, but who do you see as being able to be called a neighbor general? Who is it that will love the people that you have failed to love? Or it's an entire reversal of the question entirely of who is my neighbor, not who do I have an obligation to love, but who loves me? What if this man and this lawyer is meant to identify most with the man beaten on the road? What would it be like to accept mercy from your enemy? What group of people would I just, no thank you, I don't need your love? So this is where my 4-year-old self couldn't understand all the subtleties of what was happening. I thought Jesus is making the point that the man who got robbed, the one in need, the vulnerable one, he's my neighbor. And he is my neighbor. But that's not what Jesus asked. Jesus asked who was the neighbor to him. Now, in order to understand how we're going to define neighbor, we need a quick little English grammar review. So in a sentence, you have a subject, a verb, and an object. Your subject does the verb to the object. The sentence here is, love your neighbor as yourself. We have a little implicit you at the front. So you are the subject, your action is to love, and your object is neighbor. And our lawyer is wondering, who's the object? Who do I have to love? But whenever Jesus changes the question to who was the neighbor to him, he changes the whole way we're about to approach defining neighbor. The neighbor, the object in the sentence, is not defined by any characteristic or any title or anything about the person. It is defined by whom the subject chooses to love. I would say that we're pretty comfortable with removing any barrier to define our neighbor. Our neighbor is everybody. we're comfortable with saying that. It's certainly hard to do, and we have many more ways to learn and grow and actually practice that, but sure, we agree. Everybody is our neighbor. But would we be okay with taking back the responsibility of defining who our neighbor is? We're still not defining them by any characteristic about them, but defining them by who we choose to love. It seems as though there's a question at the end of the story. Who's your neighbor? Well, who do you choose to love? You see, our lawyer was trying to direct the attention off of himself back to the object. And Jesus has taken us right back to the heart of this command. And it is a command to love. Love God, love neighbor, you. You love God and you love your neighbor. And in a sense, Jesus certainly is universalizing the term neighbor. Our lawyer looking to be justified is most likely looking to define his neighbor as his fellow Jews, people in his own ethnic group, people he lives near. But the only justifiable answer is not anything about labels of identity. The only justifiable answer is what is actually done. The answer is cutting right through the heart of the tribal, ethnic, and racial tensions of the day. Your neighbor is everybody in your day-to-day that you choose to love. Now, I wonder why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. Before we quickly distinguish ourselves from being either of them in this story, let's consider all the factors. They are journeying from Jerusalem to Jericho, meaning they probably just finished their last shift at the temple, which also means they probably have their payment with them, which would have been in the form of food. So if they were to stop and touch this man, this bloody, bleeding out man who's probably gonna die anyway, if we're honest, all of their food is unclean and they can't eat any of it. Maybe we're not so different from the priest and Levite if we think about it like that. Loving our neighbor would cost us food, would cost us something of our job, or would cost us just time we simply just don't have. Perhaps they were in a hurry. Perhaps they were too scared to stop. This road that Jesus has set our story on is quite dangerous. As we see, somebody has already gotten robbed and beaten up. And hey, who knows, maybe he's a decoy. None of these answers are justified in our story, but if we're going to know how to love our neighbors, shouldn't we know what would keep us from doing so? Fear, hurry, self-preservation, fatigue. And now, in our day and age, we get to add globalization and living in the digital age, where we are interconnected more than ever. This term of neighbor is growing quickly, and very, very largely, where we can't even see who all our neighbor could possibly be. I think to our list, we could add reasons for not stopping as distraction, detachment, and just ignorance. Today, we might not simply stop because we were just so busy we didn't even see him lying on the side of the road. I mean, for me, how much easier is it for me to just watch Netflix instead of having dinner and getting to know my actual next-door neighbors? Jesus may have been making the term neighbor mean more, but he certainly didn't make it mean any less. And then, in our present-day economic structures, we don't even know who made our food or who made our clothes, who grew our food or made our clothes, because that has now been so far removed. Dr. Cynthia Molebeda, in her book Resisting Structural Evil, says, "Were someone to say to me, 'Cynthia, shove the tribal people off their lands in the Orissa province of India and kill the protesters because we need to mine bauxite for the land,' I would refuse. Cynthia, your next task is to evict this woman from her tiny apartment. Her wages don't cover the rent, and we will keep her at minimum wage in order to hold down the cost for your clothing and household goods. She says, were you and I asked to commit these deeds, we would exclaim no, crying out that such acts would betray our values. Yet we continue to live according to economic practices and policies that effectively, albeit indirectly, follow these unacknowledged commands. We live in an economic system where we can be withholding love for our neighbors just out of ignorance of how garment workers are being underpaid and treated. That is intentionally set up to be out of our sight. But I am not here trying to overwhelm you with these large economic policy problems that I don't know how to fix either. My point is that if we are going to choose to love our neighbor, it is going to be an upstream swim in our culture. To choose to love our neighbor is going to take resolve and intentionality, which are both things that God's love embodies towards us first. The danger to warn against in our over-connected era is that without intentionality, everybody is my neighbor can easily turn into no one is my neighbor. To love with this kind of neighborly love that comes from God first, we have to see first how interconnected we might be. We go again, we will go against the grain of our natural inclination in order to make room to love our neighbor. This looks like choosing to learn about injustices built into systems and then building structures to protect the repeatedly oppressed. To offer neighborly love will look like adopting a prepared posture to share our resources and to share our time. Intentionally buying extra food for another seat at the table, or building intentional time into our rule of life. In order to live generously, we must reject a scarcity mindset that lets fear decide where our resources go and adopt a mindset of trust in a God who is caring and generous first. To love neighbor is to expect to give of our time and money. It is to live a life of radical simplicity for the sake of radical generosity. It's a tall order. And I would assume most of you are not starting at ground zero. There are people in your day-to-day life that you already love, and you probably have more experience and do it better than I. But we come back around to this familiar story to remind ourselves again that love of God and love of neighbor is still what we are walking towards. It's going to keep requiring transformation and power from the Holy Spirit. It will continue to require humility and perseverance and grace and dedication to keep walking towards this end goal. This command is our heritage. It is our way of life. That on the road towards God, we love those who we meet along the way. Neighborly love, all of it. Getting to know our actual neighbors and having them over for dinner and throwing block parties. Fostering children, singing happy birthday, opening hospitality houses for asylum seekers. Crying with your friend in grief. Sharing a granola bar with a man on the street corner. Learning more about where your clothes come from, writing policy to protect workers, standing in solidarity with the oppressed, stopping to clean and bandage wounds. All neighborly love is the kingdom breaking in the here and now, and it's our way. Let us continue to grow and walk in it, and perhaps we would do good not to assume who we will and who we won't meet along the way.